Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So guys, I have some amazing news. On International Men's Day, November 19th, come and join me and some esteemed guests such as Johnny Benjamin, Simon Thomas, Hope Virgo, Tom Chapman, and more as we partner with Sure Mind Charity, Beyond, and the Lions Barber Collective for an evening with some of the celebrated authors from Trigger Hub, debunking myths around men's mental health. As a guest, in person or online, you will be part of a conversation as we tackle some of the all too common man myths from my book, Time to Talk, How Men Think About Love, Belonging and Connection, what it really means to be a man in 2021. It's not one to miss, so head to the link in the description to RSVP today or head over to mantalk.live to get your tickets now. That's head over to mantalk.live to get your tickets now. Welcome to Time to Talk. Passing, fetishization, colorism, mixed race identity. These are the topics I have the pleasure of speaking to my friend Natalie Morris about this week on the show. Her book, Mixed Other: Explorations of Multiraciality in Modern Britain, came out in April, and we explore what it means to be mixed race in Britain today. The book comes at an essential time, especially in Black History Month, where it can bring up very strong feelings of exclusion for mixed race black people when entering the conversation. And interestingly enough, out in cinemas this week is Passing, the new film written and directed by Rebecca Hall, starring Ruth Negar and Tessa Thompson, about African Americans who had skin colour light enough to be perceived as white, which is known as Passing. And it's out in cinemas on October 27th. And will be on Netflix on November the 10th, and is based on the 1929 novel by Nella Larsen. Natalie and I have an in-depth conversation about what it means to pass, especially today in the age of Meghan and Harry. We also talk about the identities of mixed-race black people, fetishization from within and without the black community, and what books Natalie wants to share with us this week. Natalie and I have worked together as journalists before, and she is Deputy Lifestyle Editor at The Metro, covering race, mental health, women in sport, and women in the workplace. She has a column called Mixed Up on metro.co.uk, and she hails from Manchester and is doing the work to make the newsroom a much more inclusive and diverse place. You can find her on Twitter and Instagram at NMOZZNMOZ. I do hope you enjoy this episode. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe, and share far and wide. Now, let's get on with the show. Welcome, Natalie Morris, to Time to Talk. How are you doing?
I am good. Thank you so much for having me. So nice to chat to you on this.
But how's everything going for you?
Everything is going okay. Yeah, I'm enjoying the sunshine after all of the rain. Work is busy. Obviously, the book is out in the world now. It's been out for about 6 weeks. So that has been a total whirlwind. And yeah, just getting used to this this new space of being an author, I guess, and having that big body of work out in the world and you know, reacting to all of that. It's been really positive and very exciting, and I'm trying to sit in that moment and enjoy it and be happy that it's done and not immediately race on to okay, what's next, as I am want to do as a person. So I'm trying to give myself, you know, that time.
You know, as like, you know, it's so weird, we debuted in the same month. It's like two rap artists like debuting their album, dropping
like
their single.
That. Yeah, we're the same. It's basically that. Yeah.
So let's delve in. think it'd be remiss of me not to kind of ask you just a bit about where you come from, where that lovely accent comes from, and just about your idea of what it was like growing up for you. So yeah. Talk to me.
Well, I'm originally from Manchester, which is where this northern accent comes from, even though I've now been in London for 9 years. And so my sister would say that I sound like disgustingly southern at this point, even though I strongly disagree. And she's always fuming about my London twangs in my accent. But I still very much see myself as a hardcore Mancunian. I've been in London nearly a decade now, which is crazy how quick that's gone. And throughout that, pretty much that whole time, I've been working in different kind of journalism roles across print and broadcast and digital. I've worked in the ITV newsroom doing broadcast news, which was crazy, so intense and manic and very fun as well. And I've worked across different magazines and different print newsrooms as well. And I'm currently senior lifestyle writer at metro.co.uk, and I've been there for almost 3 years. And I'm loving it. It's great fun. I get a lot of autonomy. I get to write about the kind of things that I am really passionate about. I write a lot about racism and social justice, as well as like women's issues and mental health and well-being as well. So it's really, really quite a nice kind of broad scope as a journalist, as a writer. So that's kind of my day job, and then I'm finding my feet in this kind of other world of writing longer form and dipping my toe into the world of books and trying to continue in that vein. So hopefully I will get more opportunities to do that going forward, because I love it. The process of writing the book was awesome. Very hard to do alongside a full-time job. But very, very fulfilling as well. So to see that now out in the world is like epic feeling.
Yeah. Your book Mixed Other is, as you said, is around conversations with people and ideas about, you know, being mixed in the UK, whether, and that is like the varying census idea of mixed, you know, when it says mixed and it just says black or white, or, you know, and all these other, the varying ideas of what it means to be mixed race in the UK. Now, because invariably people would be assuming that when they say mixed, they assume black, white, and it's just usually that's the only idea of what mixed is. And I want to understand a bit more about how you kind of grew up in that space and what that meant for you and your identity, looking out at that as a young woman growing up in Manchester. You know, and you know, the black people that I know in Manchester have notoriously told me that it's notoriously, there's parts of it that are just really intensely black, and then it's just not. What was that like for you? Growing up,
well, I grew up in really quite white spaces, in kind of South Manchester, Cheshire area, and I went to very white schools as well. And I think that also, I think growing up in the 90s, I don't know if this is your experience as well, but for me, there was very much this kind of culture of like colorblindness was the thing. And that was like seen as a positive.
Colorblindness.
Yeah, just in terms of like the way parents and teachers and people and grown-ups and authority addressed these things, as in it wasn't addressed. And that was seen as a positive. They wanted to kind of create this idea that there was no difference between people, that, you know, we didn't need to talk about these things. And that was kind of seen as the best way to tackle it. So we didn't have many conversations about race or racism, really, in my household or in school. I don't really remember it happening at all in my childhood, apart from when specific things came up. If I did experience racism at school and I'd speak to either my parents, and they were both like incredibly supportive and open and willing to have those discussions. But I think on a surface level, it wasn't really on anybody's radar to be like, okay, we need to sit down and talk to me and my sister about race, about our racial identity, about where we kind of fit in this space, like what it means to us as a family or to us individually. That wasn't really happening. And it didn't really make me feel any kind of way when I was a kid. Like I was very privileged to not, for it to not really be an issue, apart from these odd occasions where I did experience racism, and that was obviously jarring and difficult. And I'd then have to have these kind of tough conversations about, why is this kid calling me this name? What does this mean? But as an overall thing, I don't really think I saw myself necessarily as a racialized person until I kind of got to probably my early 20s, if I'm being completely honest, after university, once I kind of moved to London and kind of started moving in much more diverse circles and diverse spaces, but also then being in the world of work and seeing how being a non-white person had a direct impact on my life in a way that it hadn't really when I was growing up. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, okay. So like being non-white, being a black mixed woman has an impact. It changes how people see me, how they view me, how they treat me, the kind of opportunities I have, the kind of doors that are open to me in lots of different ways. And that was something I kind of came to a bit later, I think. And as a result, I've had to kind of retrospectively look back at my childhood and my younger years and be like, okay, what was that instance about? How did race and my racial identity influence these different things that happened? And it's made me kind of reassess certain things and certain relationships and certain interactions that I had. So that's been a really interesting kind of journey. And I think that that's something that's quite specific to being mixed and quite common in the mixed experience. If you do grow up in quite white spaces specifically, you're then having to kind of go back and figure it out for yourself because you don't necessarily have those natural toolkits. You don't have those natural kind of connection points or people around you who will automatically understand and automatically be giving you those lessons from day one. You kind of have to figure it out on your own a bit later. That was my experience anyway, and a lot of the people I spoke to for the book had kind of similar things to say about that. So I do think it's something that comes up when you're mixed.
So it's very interesting what you're saying, because it's like coming home to yourself in a really weird way, because of the kind of the cultures that we live in is an anti-black one. It becomes this idea of you really trying to reconnect or refine or define yourself in that way. And you said that there were occasions that you experienced racism. I don't know if you want to speak on those. Any of those particular examples, just so that we can get some wider context as to what you've
Absolutely. I mean, it's all the normal stuff. Like this is nothing like groundbreaking, like, you know, just being called the N-word in the playgrounds, being called chocolate face, like all these things that horrible kids say to each other. And like, that were just like, they're just needlessly brutal. And you think about it and you're like, where are you learning this? Like, someone at home is teaching you these things. That's what I always think when it comes from kids. I'm like, this isn't an innate thing. You don't just know this. You're being taught, actively taught, that this is how you treat people of a different race. It was just the kind of, you know, that kind of childish name calling. Then as you get older, it's you know, the usual kind of microaggressions that anybody who's non-white will have, you know, deep understanding of and complete ability to relate to. And you know, even recently, like in Paris a couple of summers ago, I was called, you know, an N-word bitch on the street by some guy. And Paris is crazy for racism. For real. So there is a lot of it's stuff that any black person, any non-white person will recognize and will understand. And then on the other side of the spectrum, there is the kind of specific hostility you get occasionally as a mixed person. So I talk about in the book a time when a black guy called me a mongrel on the street because he was trying to like chirp me essentially, and I was like, couldn't be bothered.
What?
And then this is again another thing of just like women not being able to say no when men are coming onto them. Because they get immediately hostile But the fact that that word, that specific word, was so close to the surface, like that was instantly the first thing he said to me. The fact that he very much saw me as mixed and not black, and he wanted to make it clear that that was a negative thing, was a very strange and specific form of hostility. So yeah, there are many layers to it, and different forms of kind of racism, discrimination that you face when you kind of cross between being seen sometimes as being seen as a black woman, sometimes you're seen very clearly as not a black woman, but always you're seen as not white. So there's that as well. So yeah, different kind of layers to it.
Yeah, very interesting. When it comes to, I've had conversations with a lot of mixed race friends. I do kind of go back and forth in how I kind of identify them, and I know that when I naturally do say when they are black, when they are mixed race, but they have a black parent, yeah, I automatically go for, this is my black friend, sort of thing. Or like, you know what I mean? Like, you are black. Mm-hmm. And then I've had numerous conversations, even in my household, like my family, just about kind of what it looked, you know, because, you know, they'll be like, oh, you know, my cousins will be like, well, no, mixed race people are mixed race. And I'm like, but isn't that kind of exclusionary? Like, so what does that mean? And they're like, well, no, because that's what they are. That's how, quote unquote, they identify. Have you spoken to every mixed race person? So it becomes this big debate within the black group family. Yeah. So I just wanted to speak to you just about what that means for you.
Yeah.
Because it must be quite isolating sometimes to, you know, identify with, you know, obviously the color of your skin, and, you know, and within a community, and then for the same community to be like, well, you're black, and then you may think you're mixed, and there's so many, and people within the mixed community would be like, well, we're mixed. What do you say to me?
Oh God, it's such a complex. I can only speak for myself and my own experiences, and for, you know, for anyone I've spoken to for the book. So, from my own perspective, I think it's incredibly complex. It's something that's incredibly context dependent, and changes depending on who is seeing you, where you are, where you are in the country, where you are in the world, how old you are, who's around you. There's all these different elements that play into it. So there isn't, I find that often isn't a kind of a definition of how you can identify when you're mixed or you have mixed heritage. And I think that's very clear in the kind of the wide variety of language that is used that by people who are mixed. It's all these different words, different terms, different phrases. And I talk about that very early on in the book about how I refer to myself as mixed, as a black mixed woman. But there are people who would say that, you know, dual heritage, biracial, multi-heritage. There are all these different terms that people use. And language is obviously so important when we're talking about these kind of things. It's not a superficial thing at all. But it is always evolving as well. It's something that changes over time. And I think that's a really good thing. So I think when it comes to identity and how we're defining ourselves, I think the key thing is to empower mixed people to be able to define themselves how they want to. Like, it's up to them really to define their own experiences, because only they know what their specific experience is. No matter how they look, no matter how it looks externally, they know how they feel in terms of the different communities that they're involved with, the different elements of their family heritage. They know how much affinity they feel. They know how much influence each element of their heritage has had on who they are. And I find that what can happen when you're mixed is that power to do that is so frequently taken away from you. And more often than not, as a mixed person, you're told by other people what you are and what you are not in no uncertain terms over and over again. And that's incredibly disempowering. And that, I think, is what can make being mixed feel isolating. There's nothing kind of inherent about being mixed that means you're like confused or you don't know who you are or you don't belong somewhere. It's how other people respond to you and the way that they disempower you by telling you what your label is or what your label isn't. So there's so many people I spoke to in the book who have said that their idea of who they are has changed over time depending on what people have told them. for example, Luke in the book, he's mixed with Black and white heritage, and he spent a long time as a teenager being really adamant that he was a Black man and he wanted to identify as that, and he really leaned into that and was really trying to kind of almost overcompensate to kind of prove a point and be like, no, this is who I am. And then he got to university and he was told by some Black friends that you don't get to call yourself that because your experience isn't the same as ours. And he took that on board and he took some of that on and thought about it and thought on it and was like, you know what, that's true. I have a different experience. I don't have the same lived experience as people who don't have white heritage. And so now he identifies as mixed rather than Black. So you can see, I've seen how it's so different for different people. Yeah, it's a really complicated one. For me personally, I see myself as mixed, but as I would say, I'm a Black mixed woman, and I don't find that a. I think that's an accurate way to describe. Yeah, exactly.
You explain that very well and very clearly as well, because I think that that makes the most sense. And it's just even looking back on it, just even when I was at school. I remember year nine, a whole group of Black boys, like black boys, yeah, were sent to this kind of Black, you know how they're always doing these things for Black boys to go and do some stuff to inspire them.
Yeah.
There's always somebody there to inspire them to be better. Anyway, so we got sent, and my friend didn't get picked, and he's mixed race.
Okay.
And I was just like, why? So why aren't you coming? And he's like, I'm not Black enough, clearly. And I was like, okay, like, and then I was just like, you know what, that's actually, I just put it in the back of my mind, and I started kind of like searching through those memories,
yeah,
you know, as you age, and kind of just hearing conversations and stuff, and I was just like, actually that must have been really tough for him, because, you know, a large amount of his friends are Black,
yeah,
and he identifies as a Black person, yet he is not, he's excluded from a, yeah, lot of conversations,
yeah,
as well, and excluded from a lot of experiences too.
It's, I think it's really jarring to kind of feel a certain way about yourself and then not have that reflected in how other people see you. And I think that can be, like, you know, really destabilizing for your sense of identity and for your sense of self. And again, it comes back to that empowerment and just feeling like, oh, wait, so I don't get to decide where I fit. That decision seems to be in the hands of other people. And that's, I think, what's been really nice about the book and about speaking to so many mixed people is kind of realizing that there's this kind of longing and for that connection with other people who kind of exist in these liminal in-between spaces. And that's been really nice, kind of bringing those together and finding that kind of community, even though obviously, like, being mixed is so varied. It's such a widely, like, heterogeneous experience. Like, it's hugely, hugely different. But I think at the heart of it, there are things that can tie our experiences together, and it has been quite powerful to find those connections and to think, do you know what, there is a kind of community here. And the amount of messages I've had from people since the book has been out saying, you know, this book has made me feel seen and made me feel like I'm not on my own with these thoughts, I think that's what's important in finding those connections. Yeah.
So your book goes through several chapters based on the different kind of areas that, you know, of life, but, you know, specifically from a mixed race lens. And one of the things I found really interesting was the idea around fetishization itself. And that kind of, that stems back to as far as slavery, I would imagine, even probably, that's as far as I would probably place it. But what do you have to say to fetishization and what that means, and kind of what did you pick up and learn about that through writing the book and your own experiences as well?
Yeah, it's it's definitely seems to be a kind of big part of the mixed experience, particularly as women. I do think it's a gendered thing, and from the research I've done and the kind of studies that I looked at, it definitely seems to be kind of a female experience, in a sense, in terms of the way we're presented in the media and in films and in literature and the kind of beauty standards that exist. And I think what's been interesting for me in looking at that fetishization and the way mixed women who fit a certain specific blueprint of mixedness are kind of pedestalized and put on this kind of pedestal of being seen as the kind of more beautiful thing that you're kind of aspiring to for if you have certain features and you're ticking those boxes. And it's a really strange kind of phenomenon, really, because I've seen it shift over the course of my lifetime. Because when I was younger, growing up, there was nothing covetable about looking like I did. Like, the features that I had weren't kind of being replicated in magazines or on TV, or people weren't saying, oh, I wish I had hair like yours, you know, quite the opposite. In fact, like, I was desperate to have that swishy ponytail like all my white friends, and because that's who I saw on TV, that's what was beautiful at that time in the 90s and the early noughties. And then as I grew older, you start to see that shift, and all of a sudden there's loads of women who look like, you know, Georgia Smith on the billboards and on the adverts and on the JD Sports adverts, and they're kind of being held up as the epitome of beauty. And there's this kind of it's a aspiration towards a kind of racial ambiguity. This kind of, you don't really know where somebody's from, you can't really tell, but there's a kind of drop of exoticism in there that they can, a bit of spice that people like without it being too far in any direction that's going to make it problematic or too worrying. And that comes with that kind of palatability and that proximity to whiteness that you have if you're a mixed person with white heritage. So it's a really interesting place to sit, because it's often posited as progress and something good, and in a way even people who are aware of it as fetishization are still like, yeah, but is it a stepping stone in the right direction? Does it start with kind of light brown people and then soon we're gonna, you know, widen out that acceptance? And I just don't think that's what's happening here. I don't think this is like a linear progression to opening up to wider diversity. I think it's a very specific kind of racial ambiguity that is being fetishized and lauded. And it's not necessarily a gateway into opening up for wider channels of diversity. It's just people capitalizing on this one specific look. Which is why I think that there's so many kind of influencers and social media stars and Kardashians, etc., are essentially blackfishing or mixed fishing and picking, cherry picking those elements of blackness or mixed features that suit their brand.
It's trying to be racially ambiguous, yeah. Just, you know, yeah, and just, you know, you want all of the fun but none of the struggle.
Exactly.
So
it's
all of that. But it's actually in the book you said about when it comes to fetishization, it can only go one way. Mm-hmm. It's the powerful exerting the power over the powerless, I would say.
Yeah.
In that specific context. So it can never work the other way around. And
it's a paradigm, right? Like, you can't, it's the same in terms of like racism and how that works in terms of, you know, this is people who these are the people who are deciding what's beautiful. These are the people who are deciding who gets to be acceptable in the face of wider society. And they're always at the top. So, you know, white people are the kind of gatekeepers of what is deemed beautiful, what is deemed acceptable, what is deemed attractive. And it can't be flipped the other way. So and that's why I think it's so problematic, because it's so tenuous. It's so, you know, the fact that because whoever the powers that be have decided that looking mixed for this 10-year period or this 5-year period is something that's good, that can very easily switch again. This isn't like, you know, a haircut. This isn't like a trend, like, oh, everyone loves the Rachel haircut from Friends, betraying my age there. This isn't a haircut. This is a racial identity, and when someone decides that looking like a certain racial identity is trendy for a time, that's really damaging for the people who don't get to pick and choose when they look like that and when they don't.
So what do you say about intraracial colorism and prejudices and those sorts of things? Because, you know, there are, like, there are black people who they will date, they will actively go and seek out people who are of lighter skin or of different kind of racial heritage. So whether that be East Asian or Southeast Asian, just kind of, or South Asian, just to kind of, you know, change the cultural, the, you know, the cultural genetic system, just so that children can quote unquote look better, have better hair, have, you know, and all of that stuff. And I look at that and I think to myself, you know, there's so much there that we haven't really kind of unpacked as a community. You know, we have the colorism conversation. We know that there are, there are texts and there are people that have, like, been vocal about this stuff for generations. But I think for today, this is why your book is so important, but I think, like, for today, having these conversations is it's challenging. But how do you have those conversations within your family, especially specifically within your black family, about where you sit as a mixed person with lighter skin than, say, you know, other black people?
It's difficult. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one. And I think it's a, that's a really interesting point you make about colorism in terms of dating and intra-racial colorism. And I think that's a really big issue. Something that I wouldn't necessarily know enough about to speak on in terms of how much that is actually still happening, how much work has been done on that in black communities. In terms of my experience with navigating those spaces in my own family and in wider communities as a light-skinned mixed woman, is I think it's very crucial to be able to acknowledge the reality of your position. And I think the problem when we come to conversations with colorism and privilege, is so, and how it so frequently becomes defensive and accusatory and very difficult to talk about. And I think that ultimately comes down to a problem that is a human failing, I think we all have, of not wanting to acknowledge privilege and not wanting to acknowledge that we've had a leg up in any way or that we had certain doors left open for us. I think that's a human thing, or at least a Western cultural human thing. And that's something we are constantly pointing at the white community to do better. And we say we have to, you know, you have to talk about white privilege, or, you know, economic privilege as well, as something that I think we've got a lot better at discussing. And I think that the next step is that we have to look within racialized communities at the different levels of privilege. And that is on mixed people and on lighter skinned people to acknowledge that colorism is real and that we benefit from it. And I think it's very difficult for some people to do that because it happens alongside also experiencing racism and discrimination and microaggressions. So it's even harder to acknowledge privilege when you also experience some of the other stuff as well. And also because I find that privilege, in my experience, and in a lot of the, in the words of a lot of the people I spoke to for the book, that privilege is very tenuous, again, and often dependent on other people and who is seeing you. So as a light-skinned person or as a mixed person, you don't get to walk into a room and say, right, today I'm going to use my light-skinned privilege. It very much depends on where you are and who's seeing you. Again, like I said before, about sometimes I'm seen just as a non-white person or as a black person, and sometimes I'm seen as someone who has privilege, who has lighter skin, who is closer to whiteness and therefore has more opportunities. But I don't get to decide when I use that. So again, that makes it hard to hold your hands up and be like, I do have privilege, because I think so many people feel like, well, how much of a privilege is it if you don't get to wield it to when it, like, at your whim. Like, it, this is up to, and again, it's always a sliding scale, with whiteness at the top. So I think for anyone who's underneath that, it's very hard to acknowledge that you are benefiting from that system. So, but I think that's where we need to get to. And that's how we're going to improve these conversations, is by just that honesty, and the fact that just understanding that that duality can be a thing, that you can experience racism, but that, that and that you can also have privilege at the same time. Simultaneously, these two things can happen, and one doesn't negate the other. And I think we do have the scope for that, for those conversations. And we have the scope to talk about the mixed experience without it kind of crumbling into this, like, competition about whether it's harder or less hard. It's just a different experience, and I think we're able to talk about all of those experiences.
Yeah. The one thing Toni Morrison taught me before she passed, when she sat with me in her books, because she never met me, she never knew I existed. But but what she did have was this conversation around passing. And I remember reading it in Song of Solomon, and also in The Bluest Eye, about this idea of passing and what that means. So I've got 2 points I want to ask you on. The first one is about navigating the world of work as a mixed race woman. What does that look like for you? And, you know, because you've written loads of things around, you know, I think you wrote a recent piece for the Metro about, you know, a percentage of people in the workplace still don't like to use the word black. And I was like, ha! Okay, Natalie is turning tables over and throwing that stuff in there. But like, so that's one thing. But and what that feels like for you, but also just kind of like navigating that as somebody who is up against somebody who is darker skinned in that space. How do you kind of challenge? How do you kind of navigate through a world such as journalism, which is notoriously very white and middle class, you know, to get through what you've done? What has that experience been like for you?
Yeah, it's tough. You know, journalism is 94% white. The newsrooms I've worked in have been overwhelmingly white, and you can't help but feel that, like, you feel it. And this is, and I have so much privilege in that I have white heritage, I have white family, I grew up in white spaces. So I have an inherent kind of advantage in that I have more understanding of how to navigate those spaces, and kind of fitting in those spaces is much easier for me than it would be for certain other people who are darker skin, for example, or who are monoracial. And I still feel it. I still feel like, okay, I can feel this difference. And particularly, you know, writing about things that I write about, like I'm writing about racism, and you come up against opposition at different points from different places of authority. You come up against people who don't share your worldview, who don't understand where you're coming from, who think that you're this perpetually angry woman with a chip on their shoulder who's just trying to be difficult for the sake of it, who just don't get where you're coming from with these kind of topics. So it's definitely difficult. At the same time, there's also this kind of contention in being that kind of more palatable face when you are light-skinned and you are mixed. And I have an acute awareness of this, and there's been instances where I've been kind of rolled out for different kind of talks, or like you said about those about black boys being taken to places for inspirational talks. I've given some of those talks at newsrooms. I've been like wheeled out to chat to some kids from some college in Lewisham, and I'm like, hi boys, like, come work here. And there's this like instant contention with that, because obviously I want to encourage people to do that. And there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I'll be the face. Like, yeah, put me on your poster, put me in your prospectus. Like, yeah, let's show them. Like, but I also feel like my face is like spinning a lie from the outset, because I am not the reality of what any of these people will see if they do actually come in into the newsroom. There'll be me and there'll be three other people who maybe look like them, and that's it. And I feel like it's there's a falsity in that, and in me coming out and giving the spiel about, yeah, come and work in journalism. Because the reality is that it's going to be really difficult, one, for them to even get in that room, and two, for them to thrive in those spaces. So I'm constantly battling with this internal dilemma of, do I push for this? Do I keep championing and trying to get more people in at a junior level when I have firsthand experience of what that's like and how difficult it is, and see how much non-white talent the industry is hemorrhaging, because there's a kind of glass ceiling you get to kind of middle management, you get to kind of mid senior level, and there's nowhere else for you to go because you're not being promoted any higher than that. So it's very hard. Yeah. It's very hard because you want to be the face, you want to encourage people, but you don't want to bullshit them. You don't want to be like lying to their faces. Like,
and you know, and this is why, even like, and this is just like a slight tangent into journalism, just a bit, I just didn't want to be that person that was doing that. At one point I did want to be like, all right, yeah, let me talk to black guys and get them into the place and da, 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 da. But then also, if I'm not inherently happy in this place, why am I going to go and stand there and try and bring people in? And I just felt like it was harder to be able to do that, because I wasn't living authentically in that space, and I would only be doing it for an idea of myself, and I just didn't want to have to do that. But I can understand where you're coming from. I completely empathize. It's so challenging, especially in a lot of these industries that are 90%+ white, and you just have to and then there will be a report that comes out and they say there's no institutional racism. You're just like, well, the newsrooms, the boardrooms, the offices, the anywhere in a lot of these industries are not diverse. So what are we actually saying to people? What are we doing if we're just kind of gaslight them and tell them that it's just not an experience that happens in the UK? And I just find that absolutely strange. The second thing I did want to ask a bit though is about whether you would marry into the royal family. You had a chance, you know. Would that be? And I'm not blaming anybody, you know. But if you had the opportunity, would you have ventured down that road?
I mean, that is a strong no from me. Like, absolutely not. And I cannot. Like, Harry must have some seriously good chat, because I don't understand why Meghan would give up her sweet life for this absolute mess that she's walked into. Like, she must be deeply in love with this prince, like, deeply, deeply and truly. And I love that for her. And I'm, you know,
the sauce.
They must have something magic going on, because why on earth would you do this? And I, this is how I felt from the very beginning. And I think a lot of people did. And particularly when she was, you know, everyone was buzzing about how we're going to have a black princess, and it's going to do this. And it shows how amazing we are and how liberal we are. And I was like, oh no, this is going to be awful for everyone involved. Like,
what is that TikTok song? Like, oh no, oh no. I get you. And I saw it and I was just like, because I'm deeply optimistic. I'm a very optimistic person until proven otherwise. And I was like, oh my God, like, so they're fully accepting a mixed race, a black mixed woman into the space. They had the blackest wedding. Mm-hmm. It was the sunniest day. Yeah. You know, she's popular. Harry's just happy. He's grinning from ear to ear. Like, what a wonderful day for post-racial friend. I was swiftly thrown out of that room. And it just kind of makes me, it's just that added question to passing and what that means when you get to the space. Because if you can also look at it from a perspective of, Meghan's gone into that space and disrupted it. And she was able to get to that place to disrupt it from that point. And he would never have been able to do that had she been a dark-skinned black woman. And I think, because it probably would not have gotten further than the dinner that they were at. Like, you know what I mean? Like, definitely. It probably would not have happened. Because I always go back to the Marchioness of Bath, I think it is. I forgot what her full name is. But she's a Nigerian, she's a mixed woman.
Yeah.
I will send you, I don't know if you know who this person is, but I'm going to send you stuff after because I've completely forgotten. I'm blank. But she's a mixed race woman. Okay. And she, you know, her dad is a Nigerian oil baron. Her mum is an English woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's wealthy. Like, she's a wealthy mixed race woman. And she married into this elite family of, you know, aristocrats. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, oh, you know, it's fun for a while. The family was saying it's fun for a while and all this stuff, and, you know, but you're going to dilute the blood, and, you know, the blood is this, the blood is that. It was like you're a stain on the family's history and all this different stuff, to the point where certain family members, his mum and dad included, did not attend the wedding and all of that stuff. So I look at, you know, I just want to know what you think about passing, and we can head off down the merry road into rounding off this conversation.
Well, I mean, I think you make a really valid point about Meghan disrupting in that space. And I hadn't actually really thought about it like that in terms of, you know, the fact that she's been able to get into that position to have such an impact in terms of the conversations that are now being had, the way that people have kind of shifted their opinions about the royal family. I don't know. It's very, we'll have to, I think it's still to be seen how much of an impact any of this Harry and Meghan drama will have long term in terms of the institution and how people view the monarchy. But, you know, at least these conversations are being had, and there is at least some thoughtful conversation and discussion being had about it, which is a positive. And for her to be able to get herself into that position to have these conversations is a powerful thing. And I think that's another thing that is almost a responsibility of people who do have that privilege. And part of the reason I relate it to my own experience within newsrooms and within journalism and the kind of stories that I'm trying to tell and the kind of work that I'm producing. And I'm acutely aware that there's an element of that that comes down to my privilege enabling me to do that and to be in those spaces and to have the autonomy and the position of seniority that I do in order to get those messages out there. And I think that's why I'm compelled to keep going with it and not just drop away and be like, you know what, it's too hard, it's too much responsibility, because I want to. And I think I've got to use the privilege to be in this space for something good. So I think that's an interesting parallel between myself and Meghan, probably the only parallel. But yeah, and also, like, but passing is something that's really fascinating and something I wanted to look at deeper in the book. It's something I don't have direct experience of. I don't pass as white. I'm very clearly not white from looking at me, but there's a lot of mixed people who do. And I think what's interesting is how the connotations of what that means has changed over time. And, you know, if you look back at, for example, Nella Larsen's book, Passing, and the way it's historically spoken about in like 20th century literature and films, it's always this kind of deception, this inherent kind of sneaky, devious thing that mixed people are trying to wheedle their way into white society and cast off their blackness and distance themselves from blackness.
Yeah.
And
it's a denial of one.
Denial,
accepted in another.
Exactly. And they're trying to give themselves a better life, abandon their family. They don't care. They get to be white now. Brilliant. And that's always how it was presented. And I think there are definite hangovers from those early 20th century narratives in the way people think about mixed people, particularly those with lighter skin and those who pass, because I think that that's sometimes where that kind of a slight inherent suspicion or mistrust comes into play, where there's this assumption that mixed people are taking up space where they don't belong, or that they're trying to kind of insert themselves into something that they're not. And I think that's a hangover from this idea of passing and what that meant historically. But I think from the people I've spoken to today who pass as white, it's very much kind of the opposite, in the sense that they're very often forced to try to reclaim their minority heritage and kind of overcompensate and prove that they belong in those other spaces. So they're less trying to hide themselves as white and more trying to own their full heritage, and being, you know, frequently denied that and being told, no, you don't get to because you pass as white. So it seems it's not something I have direct experience of, but from the interviews I did, it's a really interesting place to be, and something that's not spoken about very often in terms of the conversations we have about race. So yeah, I think hopefully we'll be able to have basically just more space and understanding for people who have mixed heritage, who don't hit that kind of perfectly in the middle box that everybody seems to be talking about when they talk about mixed. If you don't look like Meghan Markle, you kind of get discounted from the mixed conversation, as it were. So I think it's really important to talk to people who are mixed, who pass as white, for example, and to talk to people who are mixed who don't have white heritage, people who are mixed with two different minority heritages. That's what I would say on that in terms of passing.
Okay. Amazing. Well, thank you for joining me today. That was an amazing conversation. I loved it.
Thank you for having me.
And no worries. I just want, before you go, two books that you would want to recommend to people.
Yes. Okay. They have to be fiction, because that's my joy in life. So I would recommend On Earth, We Are Briefly Gorgeous by Ocean Vuong. I think, I'm not sure if I'm saying his second name correctly. I would recommend that, because it is stunning. Like, it was at a point where I would be reading it, I was underlining lines, I was in the bath, I'd get out of the bath, go find my boyfriend so I could like read him a specific sentence, and he'd be like, go away, like the floor's wet, what are you doing? But I was like, you have to listen to this sentence. But it was very, anyway, I had a very visceral, intense reaction to this book, because it was beautiful, and I'm just in awe of his writing, and it's how I want to write. So yeah, I hugely admire that. Second book is 26A by Diana Evans, who is a mixed writer, and she wrote a book that I think was probably more successful recently, called Ordinary People, which I also love.
Yeah.
But 26A was before that, and I feel like not as many people have read it, and I loved it so much. It's one of the best books I read last year. It's centered around these two twin girls and their experiences both in London, I think like Kilburn, I think Northwest London, and in I think Nigeria they go and live. So it's kind of across the two, spanning the two two different places that they lived, and covers their entire lives, and it's very beautiful, lovely depiction of sisterhood and twinship, which is something I'm very interested in. So yeah, would hugely recommend that. It's gorgeous.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Natalie, today. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch or want to know more about what you do? Where do you sit on the internet?
I sit in many corners of the internet. So you can find my writing on metro.co.uk on the lifestyle page. But I'm also on Twitter at nmoz and same handle on Instagram. But yeah, I'm more prolific on Twitter, I guess. So probably go there.
Yeah.